Welcome back. Let's do a summary of the piano lesson to pave the way for the next chapter. I think, just run through the whole thing very quickly, touching on the main points, so you kind of get it. We spread it out over so many weeks, and it's so convoluted. I tried just to summarize the main points. And I will notate all the red flags so that we, when we get to the end, we can see what I would call his error in evaluation, partly, anyway. Well, it starts off, he's troubled because there are two schools. We talked about that as the need to get together psychology and physics. A little more specifically, to realize what the link is between synchronicity, which responds to the psyche, from the psyche, and physics. He goes to Arnvig 2, which is where she lived. Oh, I meant to bring it, too, darn it. There's a book just out, which is a 10th commemorative volume of the death of 10-year death of von Franz. And it's called, I'll bring it next time. I think it's called The Fountain of the Love of Wisdom. And it's essays by people who knew her. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, she lived on Hardwick too as a young.
Oh, Deutsch or in English?
It's in English. Yeah.
What did you say that statement about young?
Oh, she in fact lived at Hornweg 2. Hornweg 2 is where she goes in the, where he goes in the piano lesson.
Oh, okay.
It's the address. Mm. He hears the master's voice say time reversal, sees the master's image, and is connected with conical bags turned upside down. Conical paper bags turned upside down. First red flag. First the paper, and then upside down. That means they don't hold anything. He goes back, and he's in Vienna in 1913, which we took as the personalistic origin of his problem. He would have been 13 at the time. Remember, he was born in 1900. In Vienna, there is a captain with an ill daughter, and the captain could have asked for help, but didn't. And second red flag. There's a reference to the captain of Copernic, who was a charlatan who donned a German military uniform in order to get military benefits. Third red flag. Oh, and I think that, you know, whenever I read something like this which goes astray, I try to see, is there one, can you locate one thing that shows what's wrong? And I think that's it. Probably was dishonest. Mm-hmm. And you know, Jungian psychology does not work with dishonest people. It presupposes a basic moral orientation. We all have our little white lies, but is there a basic moral integrity there? And I think with Pauli we'd have to say no. We learned that the master wants to assert himself at all costs. The piano teacher then mentions how she was in the master's bondage at one time, and I think that is also very significant, that the Middle Ages is still so close to Pauli that he has to defend against it. By Middle Ages, I mean the time when a belief in superstition was rampant. The Enlightenment put an end to that. Then the discussion of the black and white keys on the piano, that black can play major chords and that white can play minor chords, and then the piano teacher becomes a Chinese woman. He sees the mainland to the north, which has been drained. That's probably a good sign. North probably being intuition. If you think of south, if you're in Switzerland, south is Italy, which is sensation, and the opposite of that would be intuition to the north. That's how Pauli described. He had a little geographic system of typology, and he related the north to intuition, meaning the future, dealing with the future. The master distributes newspapers, but he can't read them. Another red flag, but the people there do. The paper tells the people their names and who they are. I think really there you could say that the North is the future and the people are us. That this work will come to a time when it's understood, but he couldn't do it. And that our identity will come out of this dialogue, which is why I feel this material is so important, even though it's difficult. There's the comment that the piano is played differently according to how warm it is, and of course it's warm between him and von Franz. Then comes the real... Then there's another comment that the piano teacher makes, that she was banished 300 years ago. See, that would be at the beginning of the Enlightenment. Then comes that lecture to the strangers, where he is lifted in the air. Another red flag. He discusses the systemization of chance, which is ridiculous. So he's trying to control the miraculous. There is a pattern to it, but we only see it in retrospect. The lady says he has fathered an illegitimate child on her. Again, attesting to the bogus nature of that lecture. So another flag. And the child must be made legitimate. She asks if he has his passport, and he says no. It's nearby. Then we're told that he won't make it to the land of the north. We linked that up a little bit to Moses, and Ted asked about its meaning. I checked in Edinger, and Edinger doesn't say anything about Moses not making it. So the only thing I can figure is it's an image. Moses shows that this process has to go in stages, something like that. One, you know, the Moses part of you gets you up to a certain place, but then you have to have a period of re-inspiration to move you into the final goal. But in any case, he isn't going to make it. And we find then he has to head back to the men's world, so leaving the feminine. And all that lady represented, which was synchronicity, the emotional response to synchronicity, and the presence of what synchronicity brought into his life, namely von Franz. He then reiterates that he'll reconcile the master at all costs. Then he's given the ring eye, which he lets remain floating. The master speaks transformed from the center of the ring. I said that's a big red flag. Our author didn't, because you don't get that kind of transformation after 10 red flags and no confrontation with the error anywhere visible. So that's a paper bag. That's just talk. He asks the lady to remain merciful. And the author goes on to quite a jaunt discussing that, and I think, again, it's just baloney. We will see that she does not remain merciful. And why should she? And the author tries to show how that is some great documentation of transformation. But we're just being tricked.
What is the author trying to say?
I can't even forget all his allusions, but he goes into Faust and Dr. Marianus and Mary and the transformative feminine.
Oh, okay.
In fact, she's just duping.
Because I was thinking, I think it's in the in Jung's Ghost Book, where he talks about how he kind of communicates with the anima and in conjunction with the shadow in that kind of way, kind of like saying, be patient with me, give me some time, that kind of thing. Almost kind of, you remember that part? I think it's in the Ghost
Book. I don't, but you know, you contrast. Do you remember the dream? No, the act of imagination in memories, dreams, reflections, where Jung meets, right during the confrontation with the unconscious period, where he meets that anima figure who tells him he's Christ. Remember that? And he says, you're crazy. And then the snake wraps around him, and he starts to sweat, and he realizes his head turns into the face of the god Ion. And with that, the woman then begins to see the different relationship to the anima. There, Jung challenges its irreality. And here our author doesn't see it. He takes the woman and he takes the man at their word. That's the mother complex. It doesn't separate from the unconscious, but believes what it hears from the inside. Or the development of the ego assesses each figure and says, okay, that's genuine, but no, that's not genuine. I don't accept it. I won't make that attitude my own. But I think from now, really to the end, in varying degrees, our author is guilty of that. And as I said, I think he's a puer.
Yeah, I think what I was reading too, he wasn't really believing it. He was just asking,
give me
some more time.
Yeah.
But he wasn't really taking it.
Right. Yeah, I got your point that he is dialoguing. I just was showing it in memories. He's even stronger. He just says, you're crazy. And you have to say that to your complexes sometimes. You're crazy. I'm not buying this. And that's what is not happening here. So that what the author, and I bet what Pauli is left with, is a sense of confidence. When really what is needed is mistrust, concern that a path is being missed, where this scene lulls him into accepting what happens. And then, you know, it's just a few years until he dies. And so I think we're beginning to see how the anima works to destroy a man. And we're also going to see the author doesn't pick it up, and certainly Pauli didn't pick it up. Now, when I say the author doesn't pick it up, I think he does in degrees. But I think we'll see times when he misses it. And I think that's, you know, as I hear people do, you know, say dream works and so on, which I think generally are very beneficial, this is the biggest mistake, that people don't know what to question in the dream and what to accept. Just because it's in a dream, they accept it. And some things need to be accepted and some things need to be challenged. And we'll see, really, this last bit I mentioned, remain merciful. I think it explains the next couple of dreams. That's another reason I mentioned it so strongly. We're going to see the anima turns lethal just when he's thinking she's going to be merciful. Because she's pre-Christian. She is not interested in saving your soul. She's interested in her position being realized, or she has no use for you.
And what is that?
To address the issue of the stranger publicly.
Oh, nice.
She has a very specific goal for him, which I think is the interesting part of doing this work. And we talk about the self, we talk about fate, we talk about destiny. And I believe that's a valid discussion. But it really does come down to we're asked to do something here in time and space. And you can see in Pauli's case, that was a very specific request. Write that book, or
it's almost behaving like if you're not willing to do that, then you're not worth this.
Bye bye. Yeah, not if. That's the way she works. If the individual has within them an important gift, if they don't have an important gift, then they seem to be able to get away with a lot more. But if they have an important gift, then they're not very often able to get away with much. And I, you know, Pauli definitely had a gift and a calling. in a way, you know, it's not a blessing to have that sort of a burden. Yeah.
And so you're saying that this is kind of a naive, yes.
Right.
And so this image of the animus being, or the unlock being merciful?
Yeah.
You should challenge that, or?
Yeah. I mean, it'd be like somebody says to you, checks in the mail. You say, right. That's what's missing. Yeah, why? I mean, stop for a second. If you've ripped somebody off 10 days in a row and you ask them for their kindness, why would they give it to you? And that's the position she's in. He has totally violated her standpoint repeatedly, and then he expects her to be kind. And then he goes away thinking she will be kind. Why would she be kind? She's furious under the surface.
So it's really, in that respect, then it's really testing, challenging his own conclusion.
You know, the unconscious puts riddles. That's, in a way, part of its nature. And in a way, this is a riddle. It sounds like a statement, but it's really something to figure out. Just like when you're at work and somebody says something and you think, now, that doesn't fit with what they said yesterday. What's going on? You have to have that same attitude toward the unconscious. 10 red flags and she's merciful? There's got to be a trick here. There is a trick. Okay, 164. Now, parts of this, I think he's right on the money, and parts of it, I think he's way off. So I'm going to concentrate on the parts where I think he's on the money, try to add my 2 cents, and some of these pages we're just going to skip because I think he's way up in the stratosphere. What I do like is in the second indented quote, Jung's saying, "What am I to do with the unconscious? When it's all said and done, the inner work has to translate into some presence in time and space." Now, it looks good for a while. The quotes on the bottom half of the page. He sounds like he gets it, and I think at that point he does, though in about 2 pages we're going to see he completely flips, and he completely contradicts this good assessment here. "In principle, I no longer see any reason to accept that psychology can be assimilated in a still more general physics." Remember we talked about that, how he felt that at some points that physics would absorb psychology and there would be this neutral language, which in fact was a language of physics that would subsume psychology, which is just ridiculous. But here he is reevaluating that. "Rather, the issue is much more one of 2 complementary approaches. I came," she became. "I came," must be "I came to this," sorry. "I came to this through various dreams, of which 2 stand out particularly. And when I received 2 tickets to travel to my homeland, and it is said to me that I can only come there as a pair. The second ticket would only be for the woman. The other dream bore is having a long conversation with me, is carrying on a long conversation with me in Danish. He says in particular, I have to give the woman more money." So there it's pretty clear. And I think, maybe this is redundant, but let me try it anyway. I am not sure that they are two complementary positions. I think they are perhaps two poles of a unitary point of view we do not yet have. And that's a 100-year, 200-year, 300-year, 500-year project. Don't forget how consciousness has evolved over the last 2,000 years. We no longer believe in Zeus and Hermes. We no longer accept that the Earth is at the center of the universe. We know that force does not merely equal mass times acceleration. There have been these major shifts in the way we've understood the physical world and, conversely then, ourselves. And why would there not be another one in another 300 years? And I think maybe these are the seeds of it. He says, this all has left me quite reflective. Bohr signifies for me complementarity. Remember, is the electron a particle or a wave? Well, it's both. And thus the symmetrical handling of opposites. The woman, on the other hand, the transcendental unity beyond them. That can refer to many things, but I took it also as referring to the relationship between physics and psychology, which I obviously have not taken symmetrically enough. See, there he is right on the money. He could have just stayed there. It appears the acceptance of a continual complementarity in consciousness and an elevation of the importance of woman is important. Absolutely correct.
So he's saying that physics and psychology are opposites?
Well, he's giving them both equal validity.
Okay. Because it seems like if anything would be that middle ground, it would be psychology. You know, between matter and the world of science and the transcendent. If anything would be a middle ground, it seems like Jungian psychology would be.
I don't know.
I think where Jung came to it was that it wasn't the Hebrew. I think he felt that people thought he was, a lot of people on the outside thought he was into magic.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that aligning himself with just the fundamental stuff,
right,
he would give validity to a larger group of people.
Right.
I mean, talking about archetypes and things like that, to a lot of people that is kind of mysterious.
I don't know what the answer is. And I can only speculate. It's probably wrong, but why not? It'll only take 2 minutes. I wonder if it will be a new religious revelation where we, in fact, develop a new set of images and we begin to have an immediate emotional relationship to them. And we realize that the image is a reality in itself, and it points in two directions. It points toward the physical world, and it points toward the psychological world. So that the third thing that's coming might be a new religious revelation. That's, in actual fact, I don't think there's a conflict. The conflict is that we don't live in our images. We are abstracted mentally from our own symbolic experience. And if there is some sort of a shift what we talk about, what we try to achieve in analysis, actually becomes a living reality, then there won't be a conflict anymore. There won't be a church. There'll be religious experience. And that experience will be in an imagistic form and will realize that image points in two directions. That's as close as I can get. That's why I get so frustrated with, normative interpretations of Christianity. I think that is, in fact, regressive.
What did you say the two directions were?
Well, you can pick a couple of words, but say matter and spirit, or physics and emotions, physics and the psyche. But we don't have that experience. And it's not a moralistic judgment, we just don't have it. But, I mean, a Greek could feel that when there was a storm, that was Poseidon. I mean, they felt that. That was a living experience. Maybe we'll come back to something like that. I don't know. But I do feel that Jung's emphasis on the image could be the first step in this shift in consciousness, where we realize there are these emotional experiences which are primary. Then reason serves them. Science serves them. Religion serves them. But we as yet don't have that experience.
So even in synchronistic moments?
In synchronistic moments, you do. Yeah. Right. So I realize that's very hypothetical, but you asked, so it's just an attempt to formulate.
Does this have to do with Jung's concept of
You know, it's been so long since I've read that. I don't think it's exactly the same, but, well, what I remember out of the UFO thing was that he felt, well, maybe there is a connection. He felt that the self is now pressing on us very strongly. And it's in there looking for consciousness of it, asking us to be conscious of it, which, of course, is what we're trying to do in our inner work. But it wants to be experienced, so it is creating the fantasy of UFOs, which are mandalas. And, of course, this whole idea of extraterrestrial intelligence, which there is, except it's inside. And so that, in a way, you could say is a first crude manifestation of what I'm talking about. Yeah.
What he was saying was that that people were beginning to need to leave the earth in order to find images that explain their experiences, because the growth of science and the Enlightenment and the global experience, there was no place to put those experiences here.
He may very well have missed
it. Because there was a physical reality that you could go to and say, oh, well, that tree really doesn't talk. But, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. He could very well have.
At this point in time, and then, of course, that pretended the whole actually going up in the space.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that, and we need to move further out in order to find these creatures that we can have experience with.
Yeah.
For some people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd buy that.
It's just another round of, you know, God just seems possible. I don't know that people think about it as God so much. It's outside of ourselves, right? To find a place to put it.
And it's mysterious.
And right.
So the mystery comes back in.
Right. And there really is no way of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
So it allows you to stay in that.
Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. Right. Well, take it, I say, with a grain of salt, but I've often wondered where we're headed, but that might be it.
You know, when you're in synchronistic, or when you have a synchronistic event, that's sort of pointing to what you're saying.
Yeah.
Although we just don't know how to
explain
it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that different from the way new images of the self and our relationship to it have come before?
It's always been in projection.
It's always been in images could be a projection. I mean, is an image a projection of something? It's not the thing in itself.
I think up to now, the experiences have always been seen externally.
Right. Not within the person.
Right. And now our ego has developed to the point where some people can distinguish inner and outer. Still, you watch a lot of people, it's hard.
That's what the whole mythic study is about. I mean, all myth is nothing more than creating a relationship to images in these various ways of humans. We've always done that in order to have a conversation with the mystery.
So I think what you're saying, I mean, I completely sense that what you're saying is absolutely true, because it used to be that people were in communion, but it was participation with speech. I mean, mm-hmm. they separate themselves from it. And now the duality is so split mm-hmm. that we can see it.
Yeah.
And so the return is coming back with on a new level of consciousness.
Right, exactly.
And so what mm-hmm. that's going to look like is intriguing, mm-hmm. and I think certain people are already experiencing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's on a certain level of experience is already unfolding, mm-hmm. But it's very marginal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely marginal.
And I would suggest many of us have had some of these experiences, mm-hmm. but the one you can't quite describe mm-hmm. or you don't know how to. And so these new images will gradually unfold, which will allow everybody to participate.
Right. I agree.
But it's always led by a few groups of people who are always.
The weirdos.
I think about them as a type of pioneers. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They have to go and get beat up. They have
yeah.
experiences. And, you know,
oh, yeah.
And I don't think people choose it.
No, you don't choose
sometimes
it.
You get the feminine in the work.
Mm-hmm.
You think there's a new interest in alchemy that might lead the way?
Is there a new interest in alchemy?
Well, I said well, that might lead the way to this.
I'm asking, is there a new interest in alchemy?
Well, it seems like around this table it is.
Oh. We're the weirdos.
I guess you're right. We're the weirdos. Yeah, I guess that's true. But I sense that around this table there's a growing interest in alchemy.
Well, Jung certainly took it as you know one of his major paradigms. But I think the real common denominator is dissatisfaction with the current mode of interpreting things. I think that's probably what we all share. Whether it be politics or religion or psychology or whatever. Science?
But I see a lot more people trying to create the relationship, which he was interested in,
but
just ran
out of
time.
That's kind of
offshoot alchemy. Well, it's interesting because they start, you know, one starts in human material, one starts in the constellation, so there's a
movement.
Really great lecture you missed. You should have seen.
Oh, you're, yeah, no, I wanted to get
there. Nicole, no, I don't want You know, as far as his question, though, there is an interest. I mean, researching for this, yes, and there's some great websites and stuff. Jung has a very special sort of role within the current interest in alchemy. There are some critics who say, oh, we just looked at the psychological aspects, because these are chemists who want to actually take the morning dew and work with it and you know, collect it and all that stuff. But, I mean, he is definitely recognized as someone who kept this way of looking at the world alive, and so they honor him for that, mm-hmm. even if they decide to go on for it. But yeah, I think there is an interest in alchemy. And
I was struck by the fact that I keep mentioning this book by Letterman.
By?
Letterman, you know, the God particle.
Uh-huh.
It's really had an impact.
I've got it. I will read it some
more. Yeah, because he has a dialogue in that with the ancient Greek philosopher, what's his name?
Democritus.
Yeah, right.
He's the guy who coined the word.
It's really creative. It runs about 50, 60 pages. This is a dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's the guy who gave us the word Adam, I think, right?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And in that dialogue, he basically brings out the fact that what Democritus and others before him, around him, basically had it right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the alchemy mm-hmm. that the democracy comes out of. And that with all this work in physics, all this billions of dollars on these cyclotrons that Letterman and others worked on, they're basically coming around mm-hmm. to the same story. So that really impressed me.
Yeah.
That, you know, and people tend to just poo-poo all that stuff.
Before, right.
You know, but he basically said that they basically had it right.
Okay. 165. So oriented, I read Professor Jung's letter. which expressly, compare that with traditional theology, implores the importance of the feminine and moreover stresses there being at least two ways to the secret of the stone. Now I find this all very easy to accept. Let us stay with the two ways in their symmetry. By about three pages, we're going to see he changed his mind. Again, you know. But you can see how von Franz would have got sucked in. If you hear something like that, you think, wow. Just what I've been working on. And then, boom, the door goes shut. Interesting, I have my thoughts about the next quote from Jung. In consequence of the indispensability of the psychic processes, there cannot be just one way of access to the secret of being. This is Jung. There must be at least two, namely the material occurrence on the one hand and the psychic reflection of it on the other, although it will be hard to determine what is reflecting what.
Because he thought it, they were actually the same thing.
Yeah, I think he's saying that for Pali, putting that in the way Pali could understand. Jung felt would have said that they're one and the same, but for Pali, they're two sides of a coin.
Well, he does say some strange things, because this took me to Adam and archetypes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He does say some strange things to Pali. Like, he talked about the archetypes, and he at one point says, well, maybe they're acquired and pre-existent. He says it's the Pali.
You always got to ask, what's he saying?
Why is he saying that?
Is he saying it because he believes it, or is he saying it because he feels this is what it will take for Pali?
This is how Pali could connect.
Could connect with it. See, he always does that.
Right, and so I've never heard him say anything like that before.
Yeah.
So I read that, and I just didn't know how to take it.
Yeah, I think when you know that too, it helps clear up some misunderstandings about the things Jung has said.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, he told Mountain Lake, you know, the Native American, that he was from a tribe of cowherds in the mountains. Now, Jung knew he wasn't a cowherd. But he knew that was how Mountain Lake could understand in his experience, as close as Mountain Lake could get in his experience to understand what Jung's background was like. So if you imagine he does that, which is really differentiated Eros, incredibly differentiated Eros, he'll speak to somebody in the framework they know they can approach. I think it helps. And that's what I'm thinking is going on.
That's probably why you wouldn't find it in his collected work stated just that way.
Stated just that way, right. And in the seminars, too, sometimes. I think he's addressing the people where they are.
Well, the other question is, does Pali hear what he wanted to hear? You mean, talk about your honesty. I mean,
well,
is he the one quoting Jung, or...?
This is a letter.
Okay, so he did.
Yeah, yeah.
In that way.
And with Pali, you know, he had a couple of boxes. He had one box where he was honest. And he had another box where he wasn't honest.
He was honest in the science, in the way he did his science.
Right.
But his emotions and his emotions.
Or even with his emotions, he had an honest box and a dishonest box.
No.
And when you talk with people like this, this is particularly true of alcoholism. I mean, this is what AA works on in people, that you are consistent. Where when you're talking, I mean, I'm working with some non-drinking alcoholics who have not gone through AA. They quit on their own. And they'll say one thing 1 hour and come back, and it's like, that conversation never happened. It flabbergasts me. And I think Pali was a bit like that. There's one person there that's pretty good and solid, and then there's another person there who is totally different. And they can change within an hour or two. That's fragmentation. That's lack of ego. Ego is what sees contradictions in your statements and in your emotions and in your behaviors.
It's like they just forget it. Then.
They literally forget it. One person say to me, literally 1 hour, I'm so lonely, I don't think I can keep going. All my dreams are desolate. Next hour I came back, and the person said, well, you know what? I'm feeling pretty good. I think I'm about ready to stop therapy. That split. I said, excuse me. Oh, yeah, I did say that, didn't I? It's like a fog. There are literally different people inside. And it's not like multiple personality disorder. There's basically one physical person present. But there are these reactions that have no connection with each other.
And the ones that can appear like a beautiful person, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, suck you in. And then the other side stabs you in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's ego fragmentation.
That's fragmentation. Mm-hmm. When Jung talks about the opposites in alchemy, that's what he means. There are the opposites. Now, hopefully, we don't have our opposites so separate. But we all, you know, you probably, for us, there would be different moods. One mood you'd feel, yeah, life hasn't gone the way I want it. And the next day you might feel, well, not as bad as I thought, you see? And we can contain the two and then realize, well, maybe the truth's somewhere in between. But with this sort of person, it is a complete split. There is no recognition of the duality. Now, with this individual I told you about, I mean, literally I've said 10 times I brought this person back to that sort of statement, repetitive in our work. And slowly it's dawning. Slowly there's continuity. But I'm ready at any moment for it to be gone. But that's the way it works. So, you know, here I think he is his honest self. Okay, now I think he gets lost. The master here is appearing in the position of Dr. Marianus, and that's from Faust, where the figure Dr. Marianus says, remain merciful. I think that's irrelevant.
Can I ask you a quick question before you get to that?
Yep.
Right above there, he says, the quaternion modern dreams, and he talks about it. This is just above where you were reading. Indented.
The quantity of money and dreams is the creation of the unconscious. The unconscious is often personified by the anima, a feminine figure. Apparently the symbol of the quaternity issues from her. She would be the matrix of the quaternity,
Theotokos,
or Mater Dei, just as the earth was understood to be the mother of God.
So he's saying this quaternity issues from the anima. So for a woman's psychology, would you say it would have to issue from a Sophia-like figure in order to be a Theotokos?
Yeah. But take that with a grain of salt. Okay. I know. Well, with these statements, I always have to tell myself this is the top of the bell curve.
Because things happen in different ways. And
it can appear in any darn way I want to.
With one another, etc.
Yeah. Okay. But I think what he's driving at and a deeper level is that the experience of the self is something that is received. You receive it. And in a sense, then, it's a feminine experience. You don't make it. You are given it, which means you have to be in a receptive position. Well, he's trying to make some great symbolic moment out of remain merciful.
Oh, so he's still on that one.
Yeah, well, he's still on that one. I'm trying to get away from it. I think it's ridiculous. There he's identified with the unconscious rather than separate from it.
Well, I guess he's not really saying anything really happened for Polly. He's just saying what the what he was presented with from the unconscious.
You see, as the Chinese woman lets her ring hover in the air, she doesn't let it hover in the air. He lets it hover in the air. That's my problem with the guy. It's a lack of seeing separateness. I mean, you could say she leaves it hanging in there, but she gave it in the act of imagination to Pauli, and he doesn't do anything with it. He walks off. That, to me, is the point.
Well, I mean, she's an aspect of him, but he's either identifying with her totally or not able to separate out. Isn't it? I mean, if he were saying, I can do something with this ring, you know, because this Chinese woman is a part of me, one aspect of me.
Right.
Then he would need to be identifying with her. Or, and at the same time, he'd be able to separate out.
To take her as an object with whom he has to have a relationship, or as another with whom he has to have a relationship. And I don't know if you remember the Beatrice bit. Remember, they did the act of imagination, and here I like what Van Eerkelens did, and the reference to Jung's Liverpool dream. You could see in both of those, in Jung's case and in her case, the terrific price that was paid to get that center. In Jung's, it was having lived in Liverpool, there's 15 years of misery. And in the Beatrice, it was the fire. She was on fire for somebody. So that Pauli thinks you can just take this ring and waltz out of there. He doesn't want to pay the price, which would have been his fire for Van Frans. And the marriage complications it would have created. But he couldn't have had much of a marriage in the first place. What woman could relate to this kind of nonsense?
Yeah, I think that the question of free will, so much, you know, just because as much as she offers that and he doesn't take it, she can still exert herself and kill him.
Yeah.
So why couldn't she just force him to take it? You know what I mean? It's like free will is so incredibly important.
It's weird.
You're self-conscious.
This is the trickster aspect of the unconscious, which is its basic nature.
In the sense that it thwarts the ego's order.
Well, it's not, you know, it's... It doesn't give you something without there being a test.
Well, when I'm trying to see what images want to be included in a painting, it's as though there's this stabbing going on, like, oh, it's almost here, it's almost, and it's almost the unconscious sort of gives you hints, and you sort of stab around.
It's a two-part process. It gives you hints, and then you stab around.
Mm-hmm.
The image I always hold in mind, I wish I could remember the exact historical event. I think it was in the Peloponnesian Wars or the Persian Wars. One of the generals went to the Delphic Oracle and said, if I go against this army, what is going to be the outcome? And the oracle said, you will destroy a big army. Unfortunately, it was his army. So, you see, it gives you something, but then you've got to work with it.
Mm.
Okay, mm. He should have said, whose army is it? But he didn't. Yeah, and so that's why I think it doesn't do that. I just take the unconscious as pure nature. And there are sunny days and there are rainy days. And so it's not going to just give you a sunny day without a rainy one.
I mean, you're not saying that the Chinese woman is the trickster. You're saying underneath that, or is there a side with her?
I think she's the trickster, yeah. Because remain merciful, she is smiling and she's thinking, right. And that's the way all these figures are. What I notice at the beginning of analytic work, they aren't that way. They're trustworthy. But the longer you go, the more complicated they get.
So one aspect of her.
One aspect of her, right. See, Pally is pretty far along. I mean, he's done years of analytic work. And that, then the unconscious ups the ante.
And allows the free will another chance until finally it gives up on her.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it does a couple of things. Well, again, let me just back up a second. Maybe if I'm repeating, bear with me. But I think that we have to look at Jung's understanding of individuation in a much broader understanding than personal development. It is really the evolutionary process. It's our part of the evolutionary process. And what real individuation is, in the final analysis, if it's deep, it is contributing something to the evolution of our times. And that's what it wants. We are, you can look at it as a personal process for quite a while, because it takes a lot of strength to get to that point. So you are developed personally. But eventually you are developed personally to give back to the community or the state or the nation or the world in some way that it needs to evolve. So that this individuation process is not just about you. You've got the whole weight of the survival of the species behind your individuation. And the further you go, the more that weight is there. So as far as it's concerned, if you mess up, you're not just blowing your life. You're blowing a chance for the survival of the species. And that's why it gets so ruthless.
That's why the trickster comes in.
And so two things happen at the deeper level of the process. One, you're tested. You know, not unlike the Buddhists test their initiates, their novices. At each point before you're given a new gift, which it hopes you will pass on, it's a gift to yourself and a gift to your world at the same time. It tests you to see if you are worth what is being given. And that would be my final answer to you. And secondly, the more it is worth to the world, the bigger price you pay if you funk it. And you can, and I think, again, why it's, to me, so important to be doing this Pali material. Pali is really to be an instrument for the evolution of science, evolution of religion, evolution of culture. You can see all these themes that Jung has talked about in these 40-some volumes are showing up in his dreams. Because he can understand how science needs to evolve. He can understand what's wrong with religion from personal experience and from being at the source of history. I forget, I heard a statistic. I think 40% of our economy, or maybe more, somewhere between 40 and 60% of our economy goes back to that discovery in 1928. Those guys invented the physics that build computers, that send space flights, that make televisions, all of that stuff. So you see how he was practically present at a major shift in technology. And so his psyche is responding with an equivalent power for cultural evolution. And then the game gets very serious.
And I think he was kind of set up in a sense for that, because when he was over here and they were planning for the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
All the scientists got together and kind of set him aside as this pure person.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to be contaminated with this kind of
dirty
stuff.
Yeah.
And that did relate more to dissent. It was, yeah, it was about philosophy and religion.
Yeah.
Also, beyond just,
yeah, science. well beyond. So that is
so
what.
So he was kind of conditioned.
And, you know, these three guys that developed this physics, Bohr, of course, by this time was grandpa. He was a generation older than Pauli. So Pauli would have been 50s. He would have been probably late 70s. Heisenberg was a Nazi. So he was completely excluded from the physics world. Pauli was it. He was the king. You know, what we think of as Einstein, like the big physicist, Einstein was not held in that high regard. Pauli held in the physicist's mind the regard we hold for Einstein. He was the man, sort of the president of world physics, the king of world physics. And I think his unconscious then carried a corresponding response of what the world needed to hear in these areas we've talked about. So then that adds complication to these dream figures, who become more problematic because they feel there's more to be lost if they give the gifts to the wrong person, so to speak. Let's have a stretch.